Hi, this is Laura, and today I'm speaking with Steven Swinburne. Steve is a science and nature writer and photographer, and the author of 28 books for children. And he writes and occasionally also does the photo illustrations for nonfiction picture books and books for young readers. But his two newest books are really delightfully humorous departures from a lot of the stuff he's done in the past. So, hi, Steve. Thanks for being here with me today. I want to talk about Whiff and Dirty George, The Zebra Incident, which is your first novel for ages 9 to 11, and it's been recently published by Boyd's Mills Press, and it's already getting a lot of really great reviews. And everyone who's listening should check out the book's website at whiffanddirtygeorge.com, and we'll have a link to that on our Clubhouse site. So, Steve, how long have you been developing your fiction writing skills? And I wonder if it was hard to make the jump from nonfiction.
Well, actually, I feel like I've always loved storytelling. And this jump from nonfiction to fiction, I feel, was not that great, as I feel good nonfiction should always tell a story. And I think about some of the nonfiction picture books that I've done, like Turtle Tide or Wings of Light. And I work so hard to have like a beginning and a middle and an end. I want to see the arc of a story and how, for instance, in the turtle book, how the turtle comes up to the beach, lays her eggs, goes back out again, and then the hatchlings come out and we see them heading off into the water. So it feels to me, even like it's nonfiction, it feels like a story. And I always tried to work very hard at making a story. I think the biggest difference for me in writing a longer extended fiction piece is that I think with nonfiction, I always tell kids that I feel like I have a roadmap. I know where I'm going. So if I had this assignment to do a book about Abraham Lincoln or dinosaurs, I would know where to get the research. I kind of know what I need to cover. But in writing nonfiction, it's almost like you have to turn the GPS off, and you have a target, you got a goal, your characters have to get to this goal, but you can meander there and go there so many different ways. And for me, it was sort of a discovering how to get to this target, and which was a really interesting process. And I always tell people that it was the funnest things I ever wrote. I don't know if you could use funnest, but I loved it.
Well, and you talk about, you know, having a process now. In Whiff and Dirty George, you're not only developing a plot, but you're writing a mystery. And mysteries are very dependent on every detail being in the right place at the right time and revealed to the reader in the right moment. So can you describe a little bit the process you sort of figured out when you were creating this plot and this mystery?
Well, besides having it take 5 years from start of book to book being published, I mean, just so you can imagine, lots of rewriting, lots of revision. There are a few things that I had the whole way through. I had a good editor. And actually, before I even got the editor, I had a great writers group. So one piece of advice that I might give to writers is find yourself a writer's group. I mean, it was wonderful to write a new chapter of Whiff and Dirty George and excitedly take it to the group on a Saturday morning and read it and have, you know, half a dozen pairs of ears listening to this and saying, you know, feeling it out with me. You know, is the plot working? Is the character development working? Am I missing anything? And a lot of times I was. And so I'd go back to the drawing board and rewrite and revise and then bring it back and rework it and continue honing it and whittling at it. And that was so helpful in this five-year process of having that writer's group. And once I got the editor on board and I'd sold the manuscript and we worked at it, we whittled at it. And the other thing that really helped me was to have these I had character sketches for each character, so I lived with them. I knew them. I was trying to figure out every day, trying to who these people were, and a timeline of events. So you put all that together, and I think that helped me try to keep this plot going and keep it under control.
Yeah, that's a great great advice there. And I agree, the writer's group is probably the single most important element that any writer can have on their road to success. Having that input from other people is really, really vital, I think.
Right, because you can read it to your wife or your husband or your kids, and or in my case, my mother-in-law, who loves everything I write. but to have an objective group of ears and eyes, listening to this is invaluable.
Now, Whiff and Dirty George, the characters of Whiff and Dirty George are sort of very loosely based on yourself and your best friend George when you lived in London as a child.
Mm-hmm.
Are there some pros and cons to using elements of your own life in your books?
I thought about thinking about this question. I can only think of pros, although I might have one con. But I mean, as far as pros go, I spent 8 years of my early years, my first 8 years in London, growing up on those streets of North London, mucking about the streets and running from gangs and, doing what all kids do when they're 7, 8 years old. And so the setting was intimate to me, and those memories are indelibly sketched in my head, and the house that we lived in, and I that was part of me. So it was very easy for me to get back into that world. And plus, when I think about the 60s, I purposely set this novel in the 60s because it was such a vital decade for me. There were so many wonderful influences that came out and that I brought to there, had these all these influences in the writing, like James Bond, the Beatles, Monty Python. These were really important influences in the writing because I think I stole little bits and pieces of each of those elements and put them in. So for me, it was easy to use and use some of those elements from my childhood. The only con I can think about in terms of using your childhood for a fiction piece, let's, for instance, say that Whiff and Dirty George got really, really big, and let's just go way out there and say it became a movie. Would people start going, making the pilgrimage like they do with the Beatles and Abbey Road? Not that I'm making the comparisons, but, could they end up sitting on the steps of Seven Wolsey Road? Because that is an actual place. That is a place that you could go to right today. Could that become a problem?
Well, and, you can deal with that when it happens, I guess. By then you'll have enough money to buy Seven Wolsey Road and make it into a museum, and, you won't have to worry about it.
Laura, you took the words out of my head.
There you go. Now, as you said, your book is set in the 60s, and you have all these great 60s references like Monty Python and James Bond. But a lot of kids in 2010 don't know who those people are. So did you ever worry about that when you were writing the book? Did your editor ever worry that there were too many cultural and period specific references and slang? You have a lot of British slang in there too.
Well, yeah, we thought about it, and I think we finally came down on the side that we're going to tell the story I want to tell, the best story I can. And a couple of things helped us. One, we would have a dictionary, a glossary of British terms, which was great. Secondly, I started thinking about all the influences that have come before. I mean, if you ask most American kids, they might know who James Bond is, or, Austin Powers, or even more importantly, J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter. And I think about all the Britishisms in that book, like blimey and crikey and cheerio and some of the terms that those characters use. So I felt like, even going as far back as Roald Dahl, I felt like there was this whole heritage of British literature and movies and TV that has come, preceded my work. So I think I felt like I could talk about this stuff. And it's thrilling to me when I get feedback. Like, for instance, I have this teacher out in Wisconsin. She's the first grade teacher who is reading Whiff and Dirty George aloud to her first grade class. And she emailed me last week and she said, "Steve, the kids are having such a blast with the English language. They love blimey and crikey. And the kids' favorite term is, we want to go to the loo." So that thrills me that, even little kids in the middle of this country, first grade kids, can wrap their arms around a word like loo or blimey.
Well, and you make a really great point. I mean, because of Harry Potter and Roald Dahl, and authors like that, it's a much more worldly view that kids have these days of different cultures and the way people speak and the slang from different cultures. So it's really not that big a jump for most kids.
I agree. And I purposely didn't use any real 60s lingo like groovy or far out. I thought that was a little, plus that seemed a little bit Americanized. So I steered away from that. It was really more sort of real, kind of Cockney, blimey, Lou, cheerio, that kind of stuff.
And I think you did a really good job too of working those words into the sentence. So even if you didn't know exactly what the word meant, you got a general idea of what the characters were saying with the word, and it didn't stop you cold as a reader. And I
Yes.
think that's important too.
Right. I kind of learned that technique when I was writing all these nonfiction books. If you had like a science term, you kind of want to define it within the sentence.
Okay, so now let's switch gears to your other new book, Ocean Soup Tide Pool Poems. Now, this is a collection of poems in the voices of tide pool animals, such as the barnacle, the sea urchin, the mussel, the hermit crab, and each species is presented through a first-person verse and a paragraph of information. So you're presenting science facts through entertaining verse. How hard was that for you to write?
Well, actually, it actually was fairly easy, only because I knew that habitat intimately. I had studied tide pool habitat ecology in college because I was a science major. We had gone to the coast many times, so I knew the animals, I knew the habitat, and some of the things that happened in tide pools. I was also a park ranger for over 5 years, National Park Service ranger, and worked at coastal areas explaining and being interpreting some of these habitats. So for me, it was kind of a very natural progression to maybe write about it. And what inspired it was just a family trip one August. Our family went to the Maine coast. We settled in this little town called Blue Hill, just down the road from where E.B. White wrote. And every day I would haul my two daughters down to the rocky shore, and we'd spend hours, looking down into the tide pools, and I'd be holding starfish and urchins, and it was just a week of that. And then when I got back to Vermont, it was funny. It was almost like I tell people, it was almost like turning a spigot on, a faucet, and the words poured out. Now, this doesn't always happen with writing, but so you have to grab these opportunities when you can. But for me, it was like turning on a faucet. The words poured out, and I got up every morning at 5 o'clock for 2 weeks straight, and I had that book done. Now, was it completely edited? No, of course not. That was a first draft. But the voices of those animals just came out like they did. And that it felt really natural in an organic feeling.
And you're right, when that happens, you have to take advantage of it because it does not happen very often.
Oh, a lot of times it's like, you're sitting there waiting for the words to come, and your thumbs are up and down, and you're just wondering what's going to happen. But in this case, I think it was the week of exploring the tide pools and getting back, and just it all just came out. It was beautiful.
Now, because of your track record with nonfiction books and I know you have a lot of experience visiting schools, and so I'm sure you knew how important it was to tie in your book with the school curriculum. And at least in Colorado here, first graders study ocean life. So I imagine your book would tie in beautifully with a first grade curriculum. Do you find that teachers are open to using something that's written in humorous verse like this in a science classroom setting?
Totally, Laura. I've always felt a real openness for teachers to look for things that they can turn their kids on, to expose their kids to different ways to get into these different habitats. And for instance, I was at a school in Connecticut yesterday, and lo and behold, they take a science trip to the coast every year. And there I was talking about ocean soup, and one of the teachers came up to me after and said, "Oh, this is a great introduction to this habitat. I want to get a couple of copies, and the kids want to look at it." And I'm always mindful of curriculum. That seems to be in my DNA when I write something. Maybe it's from my early days as a park ranger just explaining things. So I'm always thinking about glossary and further reading and websites to explore. And in Ocean Soup, I have all that kind of reference material in the back. So I kind of wanted this book to work on two levels. I wanted it to be entertaining and draw people into the habitat, but I also wanted it to teach and teach them about what that habitat's all about.
And if you do include all those extra resources in your book, you make the teacher's job so much easier, and they're more likely to then pick up your book to use because you've already done a lot of the background work for them.
I find it important, and I think publishers and editors appreciate that you're going the extra step to give the manuscript some weight, some gravitas by adding things like a glossary and websites to explore. Because once the book is read, it's such a great thing that you can extend the book's life by visiting websites, you know, looking at other books and that kind of thing.
Now, the website for this book, which is oceansoupbook.com, which everyone needs to visit because it's probably one of the best book sites I've seen for a book with a science focus like this. And mostly because clearly you're a closet actor. And I urge everyone to visit the site and click on videos and see Steve reciting several of the poems in the character of the sea creatures. Costumes and all. So it's just hysterical. But it's also a terrific selling tool for the book. Teachers have very tight budgets, and I think that all authors need to be very mindful of that these days. And if a teacher is considering bringing an author in to come speak to their school and they have limited funds, seeing an actual snippet of the author performing a poem from his book is going to really give a sense of what Steve can bring to a classroom. And I think that's always going to give you a little bit of an edge. So Steve, was this website your idea or your publisher's, and did you design it, or sort of who was behind this whole site?
Well, it was my idea. Shortly after the book, shortly after I finished the manuscript, I started even before the book was sold, I started performing these poems at conferences and at schools. You know, I'd start making up funny voices, a Scottish accent or a different kind of an accent, and I would perform them. And they were so well received, I thought to myself, well, maybe I can do something more here. And once the book was sold, I said, well, I wonder what we could do with this. And I sat down with my nephew, who is sort of a techie guru website guy, very capable video handler. And so we went to the New Hampshire coast in the summer of 2009. And I got into those tide pools literally. My wife, Heather, held the cue cards while Sasha videotaped me performing these crazy videos in the tide pool. So once we had that down and we had that in the can, and once we saw Mary Peterson's beautiful art for the book, so I felt like, okay, we've got this great illustration, we've got these funny videos, how can we showcase this thing rather than just letting it, you know, sit there? So then the idea came up to how about a website? And what we did in a very collaborative process is that my nephew Sasha went out, I think it was on Craigslist, and said, looking for a designer for a website. And we interviewed maybe six people, and we got this guy named John Packman in London, a young website designer. And we worked, the three of us together. Mary gave us her artwork, and we put the videos up. And, you know, it was probably like a four-month process. The project probably cost, with videos and website design and travel and hotels, I'd say in the range of between $2,000 and $3,000. I paid for all that. Now, publishers, as we know, don't have the marketing dollars that they used to. And yeah, I'm going a little bit out on a limb here by buying all that stuff and investing in it, but I hope it will come back in either sales of the book or potential school visit deals. And yeah, it was my idea, but it was a very collaborative process.
Well, and I'm sure your publisher, Charles Bridge, was thrilled because it is a very well done site.
They love it. They're thrilled. They're saying it's the best book compliment we could ever have. And I think they've actually put it out to a contest that they've to see if they can win anything. I'm not sure who could win, maybe best website, book website. So they're thrilled with it. And of course, they're thrilled that I do all this marketing. They probably would like to have every author do this. I mean, there's nothing like having a website for your book. And I just decided with these two new books, With and Dirty George and Ocean Soup, I was really going to kick it up a notch to see if I could go out and create these websites that would enhance and complement these books.
Well, and I think you clearly have a good eye for marketing. Even when you sent me the galley of Whiff and Dirty George, the book was tied in string because Whiff he's a big knot expert. And you had special envelopes printed up with the British flag on the front, and it said "Adventure enclosed, open with caution." So, those were, I assume that those things you also did on your own, spent your own money on, am I correct?
That's correct, yes. Those envelope with the note, again, it's about a $700 expense. So these things do cost a little money, but I think in the long run they'll come back to help you. I mean, one of the things that my publisher had offered to do with Whiff and Dirty George, if I can use this as an example, is to create about 200 ARCs, advanced reading copies, for Whiff and Dirty George. So they said, if you get a mailing list, and I worked for about a month trying to find people that I could send out a mail an ARC to, they would pay for the postage. So they created the ARC and paid for the postage. And my thought was, well, do we just stick it in a manila envelope and send it out? Or do we try to do something a little bit outside the box, be a little bit different, and make an impact? So we created this fun envelope. I tied each one with a bowline knot and sent them off. And I think doing things like that help. It makes you a little bit different. It adds, there's so many books being published. How can you get a little bit of attention? How can you get a little bit of difference by doing these things?
I agree, and it's maybe not fair, but when I open a book that's been packaged carefully like yours was and with a little bit of originality, my first impression is the people who put this together really care about what they're doing. They're putting extra effort in here, and that sh probably translates into the quality of the writing. And I don't know, that's not necessarily a fair assessment, but you get that impression as a potential reviewer when you get a package like this. So you're right, anything you can do to make yourself stand out in a good way. And also the packaging complemented the story. It tied in with the story, and that was very clever as well. So I think it was money well spent.
I was happy to hear that. I mean, I think, just in terms of time, probably coming up with a list of the mailing list for the ARCs and designing the envelope and doing the whole mailing of ARCs, it probably was a 3-month process. And so, marketing does take time. I feel like sometimes I have to take off my writing hat and put on my marketing hat, and that's what you have to do. You, as much as I love writing and want to do it every day, I know that if I just have these Whiff and Dirty George and Ocean Soup just come out and hope for the best for them, send them on their way, I don't know if they're going to go very far. I think it does help. The writing has to be strong. There's no doubt about it. The design of the book and the illustration has to be strong. But I think as the author, you can do so much. Because the publishers, the marketing money isn't there, as we all know, and you have to become almost like a one-man, one-woman marketing team, a SWAT team, a guerrilla team, getting out there and getting your book out in people's faces.
That's true. Well, and I think if people remember that books are products ultimately, in the creation of them, they're art. But once they're published, they're a product that has to get to a consumer just like a pair of jeans or soda or a computer. And so you wouldn't have Microsoft coming up with a new computer program and then just expecting people to find it without doing any advertising.
Yeah, I love that, Laura, because one of the most revealing things an editor ever said to me, this is almost 15 years ago, this is when we first signed one of my first contracts with her. She said, Steve, we are now business partners. And that was wonderful. It's not like, okay, we're kind of arty, you know, people that are hanging out together, you know, we are business partners. It was vital for me to see that this book was now a product and it had to sell. And she wanted it to sell. So we were both in the same business of trying to sell this book.
Exactly. And there's nothing wrong with thinking that way. It doesn't devalue your artistic integrity in any way to also put on a business hat. And it's absolutely necessary if you want to be successful.
Yep, I agree.
Well, my final question for you, and you've probably covered some of this already. You know, I've known you for a long time, and I remember when you were first considering quitting your job to become a full-time writer and how scary that decision was for you. But you've stuck with it. You've made it work. And I wondered if you had any advice for other writers who are considering taking that plunge.
I would say, yeah, I've got lots of advice. And I think the biggest piece of advice I might throw out first is, believe in yourself. Believe that you can do it. Never, I like to tell kids, Winston Churchill said, never give up, never give up, never give up. Well, it's kind of like that. I mean, I know how hard it is. I was rejected 5.5 years in a row. And I sometimes, at the end of that 5.5 year stint, I wondered if I was ever going to get published. So I wrote this little note above my writing desk saying, never give up. And, you know, one of the things that I might have done differently, I went cold. I jumped out of a full-time job right into full-time writing on the basis of one sold book. Pretty scary stuff. My wife was working, which was helpful, but what I might have done is do it part-time, maybe try it out part-time a little bit, and then maybe move into full-time. The other thing that really helped me was to have a backup. I mean, I had a way to make money other than the writing and the books, and it was photography. I did photography for – I took a shot for stock photography for many years, and that brought in a little bit of money. And the other thing that helped me as I moved into this career was developing my speaking skills. That's a real must. I know there are writers out there that just want to write and illustrators that just want to illustrate, and that's fine if that's where you're at. But if you feel like you have any ability to stand in front of people and tell them your story or present your writing or your illustrations, I think it's a vital part of being an author because, one of the big things is you can make money doing it. It was a real important thing for me to go out there and try it. I would try different genres. I mean, try magazine writing, try educational pamphlets, brochures. Don't just say, well, I want to write a book. That's fine. There's ways to get eased into it. Maybe you get a newspaper column going. For a while, I was a naturalist column in about 10 different newspapers around New England. So there are lots of ways to break into this. And maybe having a 1 or 2 year slush fund might not be a bad idea if you wanted to do this full time. But try different genres. Believe in yourself. I always think photography is such an important element. I mean, one of the things that helped me sell a number of my books is that I could do the photography. I'm not the world's best photographer, but it solves editors' problems when you can say, yes, I have pictures, or I can do the edit, I can do the photography research. That's an important element in the sale of a book, that you're solving an editor's problem if you can handle the photographs.
Well, and I think you made some wonderful points there, primarily about looking at all your options and not putting everything you have on the one novel you're writing and hoping it will sell. Clearly, you thought of yourself as a professional writer and you were going to do whatever it took to make money as a writer and photographer. I think that's a really good point too. So I think the people I know who are successful have that same outlook. They do whatever they can to get published and to get their name out there. And I think that's really vital. Well, thank you so much, Steve. You've given us a lot of great stuff to think about here and a lot of great information, and I really appreciate it, and I wish you the best of luck with your two new books.
Well, thank you so much, Laura. It's been a lot of fun speaking with you, and best of luck to all those writers out there. They'll make it if they want to.